Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Telescope Talk Pro, our weekly hangout discussion designed to keep you up to date on the latest discoveries, technologies, projects, and science that's being done on ground-based observatories around the world. My name is Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space, and today we are going to be talking with members of the Giant Magellan Telescope team, which, as its name implies, is an upcoming giant telescope that's being built right now. Now, Telescope Talk Pro is sponsored by OPT Telescopes, which is a leader in telescopes and accessories for both amateur and professional astronomers, and I want to thank them for supporting these hangouts and for bringing them to you each week. You can help see what they're up to by clicking on the link in the description box below, and they would appreciate it, and so would I. Okay, so the Giant Magellan Telescope will be one member of the next class of giant ground-based telescopes that promises to revolutionize our view and understanding of the universe. It will be constructed in the Las Campanas Observatory in Chile, and commissioning of the telescope is scheduled to begin in 2024. Now, the GMT has a unique design that offers several advantages, and we're going to talk about those today. It is a segmented mirror telescope that employs seven of today's largest stiff monolith mirrors as segments, and six of them are off axis 8.4 meter or 27 foot segments surrounding a central on axis segment. So this is a really interesting design. Now, forming all of this forms a single optical surface that's 24 and a half meters or 80 feet in diameter, with a collecting area of 368 square meters. Now, the GMT will have a resolving power of 10 times that of the Hubble Space Telescope. And the project is an international consortium of leading universities and science institutions from around the world. And so that is our topic today. So let me get started by bringing up my co-host, Christian Reddy from Launchpad Astronomy. If you want to subscribe, we're streaming to his channel, and I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to subscribe to him. The link to that is also in the description box. Hi, Christian.
Hey, Tony, how you doing? And welcome all back to, my channel as well, Launchpad Astronomy. And I'm Christian Reddy, your friendly neighborhood astronomer. So as Tony said, we are really excited to be talking to some representatives from a next generation colossal telescope. This will have the equivalent aperture of 25 meters. And, well, I'll just get right on to it with our great guests we have with us today. Dr. Pat McCarthy, the Vice President for Operations and External Relations from the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization, and Ms. Barbara Fisher, the Primary Mirror Subsystem Manager. So this is great. We have the expertise on both the science and the technology that are going into this telescope. I'm really excited to welcome our guests. Dr. McCarthy, Ms. Fisher, welcome to our little show.
Great. Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Christian.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, all right, let's start from the beginning. The Giant Magellan Telescope. I gave a brief overview of what it is, how big it's going to be, things like that. Tell us a little bit about how this got started and some of the science that is driving the Giant Magellan Telescope. Pat, you want to go?
Okay, sure. Well, it came about around the year 2000. That was the time when sort of the last of the generation of 8-meter telescopes came on the sky. So you recall the Keck 10-meter telescopes came on in the early 90s. They were probably the second telescope, in a sense, to use segmented primary mirror. Around 2000, you had the Gemini telescopes, you had the Magellan 6.5-meter telescopes, you had the so-called very large telescopes built by the Europeans in Chile. And people recognized that the scientific return from those larger apertures, say compared to the 4-meter telescopes or the Palomar 200-inch, were enormous. They were larger than what one would have predicted just on the basis of the increase in aperture alone. But more importantly, people could then see a technical path forward to making larger apertures in the 30-meter range. So we had both huge scientific gains from our prior investment, a clear technical path forward, and compelling scientific goals. And so that led three different groups around the world to think about how to take the next step to build the next great discovery machine. And the GMT came out of conversations between the partners who had built the twin Magellan 6.5-meter telescopes. And what they recognized was that they had two enormous assets in their hands. First of all, they had an outstanding observatory site in Chile that produces spectacularly good images. And then they had the Arizona mirror technology, these stiff monolithic mirrors that produce fantastic images, images that at times rival the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. So what they thought was, if we could take this technology and grow it to the next scale, make a larger telescope, and put it here in Chile where the conditions are great, we could, you know, achieve enormous gains in science, enormous gains in technical ability to do discoveries. And that's where the GMT was born, in that spirit of success and opportunity that came around in the early 2000s based on our experience with the 8-meter telescopes.
Now you, as we've talked about at the top of this, you're an international collaboration. And in fact, a lot of ground-based observatories are working this way now. We've just talked with the Dark Energy Survey last week. That's an international consortium. Most people, I think now, and correct me if you disagree, but I think most of these bigger efforts on in telescopes, that's certainly true with things like the DKISS telescope on Haleakala, international partners. How does something like that get started? How does someone say, boy, it sure would be great to make use of all these great things that you've just outlined that we have available to us. Let's go build it. How do you build up a collaboration like this? Is it a one person, or does a group of people get together and say, yeah, let's go see if everybody else is interested in this? I mean, I've always been interested in this. How do people join and get interested in such a big project?
It's an important question, because there was a time in which one could do astronomy with a particularly wealthy or skilled individual could build their own telescope that would be at the cutting edge. And then it required full institutional support, often with the backers of philanthropists or donors. And then it grew to where there were essentially national programs, say the Japanese Subaru telescope, or the Europeans would build a telescope together. But now we really have to look over the global landscape to get the expertise, the resources, the organizational structure to build something this large. And typically you need a nucleus of people who have an idea, have a passion about it, have the ability to infect others with that passion. And so with GMT, we had a group that had built previous telescopes. They formed, you know, sort of working groups to discuss the science, to discuss the technology. And then we traveled around first the US and then other places in the globe to discuss the concept with people, attend scientific meetings, chat with people while observing at other telescopes, to just to try to build support and see who would be interested. And it took about 6 or 7 years to build from that nucleus to the full international partnership. But typically you speak to the astronomers first, you convince them of the scientific merits of the idea, of the merits of your technical approach, and then eventually you have to talk about, well, can you really afford this? And then when the astronomers are on board, and that typically takes, oh, I don't know, about 5 minutes actually to convince the astronomers, then they go back and they talk to their dean, and the dean says, well, that's a great idea, but no. The answer is no, we can't afford it. And then you work on the dean, and then the dean goes to the vice president for research and the vice president for finance. And typically, eventually, you wind up in the office of the institutional leaders to try to convince them that this is a good investment for their university, for their government agency, for whatever organization they lead. And that process takes typically a couple of years to convince them that this is the right move. But one thing about astronomy and about telescopes is that they really capture the imagination of people. We've never had difficulty convincing people that this was a great idea. And usually, if we work on them for a while, they see the value of it, and then they try to figure out how to solve the institutional and financial challenges of becoming a partner. And then eventually they put us in contact with their lawyers and accountants, and they make it happen.
So it's not at all a for a lack of interest or desire, but it ultimately does come down to resources, right? And specifically money. As a matter of fact, I just want to give a shout out to one of the commenters on my chat, Frank Kenny, who pointed out that unfortunately, when the University of Chicago joined the collaboration, they found it necessary to close the Yerkes Observatory. So there's only so much to go around. So making that case is crucial.
Yeah, it's important. There's also a couple things to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. Things that happen closely together in time are not necessarily causally related. The decision to close Yerkes, which was really most unfortunate because it's, you know, historically, it's a fantastic observatory. Today, one doesn't consider Wisconsin a particularly great place to do ground-based astronomy. And so I think there were forces in motion that were going to lead to that change. I think Chicago joining the GMT is probably not what caused that decision. It might have been a factor, but I think they just happened in the same time frame. But that said, one of the challenges in science is when you build a new facility, you can't always continue to operate the existing ones. In some sense, you have to make a break with the past if you're going to lead into the future. And that's in all areas of science. And that's sort of, that's part of life. I mean, that just happens to all of us, is you have to make choices.
Well, and thanks for explaining that. Yeah, you're right. It ultimately does come down to choices, but it sounds like a great choice has been made with GMT. But you know, at the beginning, we were talking about the telescope's design, and it has an unusual design. We've seen.
Well, hang on. I want to get to the design, but I want to talk about the science before we do. I got tons of pictures on the design.
Okay, all right. I was going to do the design first, then science. This is why, as you can see, this is a highly well scripted, professionally produced thing. All right, Tony, go ahead. Science.
Because we've got a lot of great images and stuff to show of how you're building it and what the design is. But the science, what all of this is driven first by what science you want to do. What is the science that you're hoping to get done with the Giant Magellan Telescope, and how is this decided?
Well, what we're hoping to do is something completely unknown and unexpected, and I say that not in jest. But there's two angles to the science planning. First, there's all the science that we know we want to do that we can't do now. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But more importantly, there's opening discovery space, enabling new and unexpected advances in science. And we've learned through many decades of planning, the planning that went into the Palomar telescope, that went into the Hubble Space Telescope, the Keck telescope, that typically the greatest discoveries that are made by these next generation facilities are not the ones that you thought about when you planned it, but are the unknown unknowns, the unexpected, the breakthrough discoveries that were enabled by the new technology, but were not necessarily anticipated. Whether that's the discovery of the expansion of the universe, the discovery of quasars, the discovery of neutron stars, the discovery of planets around other stars, well, that was anticipated, but not the incredible diversity that happens in those planets. So I hope that the next generation of astronomers would use the GMT to make discoveries that are not in any of our planning documents and are completely unexpected. But you can't ask engineers like Barbara to design a telescope by just saying, just make something that will discover something new and exciting. We don't know what, just something new. So we have to have a set of science goals that we can then translate into engineering requirements so Barbara and her team can actually deliver the telescope.
And can you maybe just give us a quick brief bullet point of some of those goals? What are some of the goals?
We have a document prepared by our scientific advisory committee, and it starts locally and asks, what are the nature and the properties of planets orbiting nearby stars? I like to think of this as getting to know the neighbors. We want to understand the nature of planetary systems. And in particular, we want to characterize planets, characterize the chemistry of their atmospheres, and ask, can we find signatures of biochemistry on other planets? So that's one of our core science drivers. The other extreme is we take advantage of the fact that light, that while it moves really fast, it's not infinitely fast. So as we look at things that are further and further away, as you know, we see back in time, and we want to use the Giant Magellan Telescope to look back to the earliest times after the Big Bang, when the first stars and galaxies formed, say when the universe was about 50 to 100 million years old, to see that era of cosmic dawn, the first light in the universe. And that's part of why you build a giant telescope to collect enough light to see those most distant and hence earliest stars and galaxies. Now, in between those extremes, there's a whole lot of astrophysics having to do with the creation of the chemical elements, the growth of black holes, the formation of galaxies, the interplay between dark matter and luminous matter, and we have a long set of scientific objectives that relate to that core astrophysics. But the two pillars really are life on other planets or the nature of planets and first light in the universe. And that's awesome. What we need to drive the design.
Great. Okay, Chris, you go.
Okay. Well, so now that we understand the major pillars of it, I have another question, but let's talk about the design, because it is unusual. Like I said, we were talking about, we've seen telescopes with these huge, gigantic individual single mirrors. We've also seen telescopes like Keck, which uses segmented mirrors, kind of jigsawed together. This is different. This is something that maybe there's only one telescope that sort of kind of does what this design does optically. Barbara, could you tell us about how this design was arrived at and what it's what you think it's going to be able to do that other designs cannot do?
And just so you know, I've got the rendering up and it's being shown right now.
Well, I think that history, Pat, would probably be better served to answer that question. My area of responsibility is a very small part of the telescope. So I'm the primary mirror subsystem manager. And so what I'm responsible for is leading the team that's developing the support structure for the primary mirror. And that, you know, so if you want to step back and talk about the telescope design in general, you know,
sure.
Okay. But let's clarify one thing. When Barbara says she's responsible for one very small part of the telescope, actually the critical part, right? Well, it's a part that it has to work. There's not just making mirrors, there's making sure that they stay in the right shape and stay in focus. And that's a critical part of the thinking and the decision-making that went into this design. So I said that what we learned around 2000 was that the Arizona mirrors, which they're built on the heritage of the Palomar primary mirror, which is a monolith. It's Pyrex, so it's a low thermal expansion material, and it's very stiff mechanically. And what we would love to have done was simply to make one 25-meter diameter mirror that would have one, you know, contiguous optical surface, would just, you know, cover all the collecting area, and that would be great. But there's two challenges. One is the experts who build these large mirrors, particularly the team at the University of Arizona at the Richard F. Karas Mirror Lab, they believe for fundamental reasons having to do with material science and thermodynamics that it's hard to make a mirror any larger than about 8.5 or 9 meters in diameter. Even if you could, there's a challenge of how would you get it from Arizona to the top of a mountain in Chile? It's actually pretty difficult. And there was a time when people said, well, why don't we just make the mirror on top of the mountain? Well, you might be able to do that, but if you did, you couldn't even pick the mirror up. It would break, fracture under its own weight. So we recognize there's a fundamental limit, at least right now. There's a practical limit in the size of an individual mirror at about 8.5 meters in diameter. So if we want to make a larger aperture, we have to segment, use a number of mirrors. And our thinking is that the best optical surfaces are those that are contiguous, that don't have gaps, don't have edges, don't have discontinuities. So if you want to minimize those, you make the largest possible mirror segments you can, and those are the 8.5 meter mirrors. Hmm. Now, there are two different technical paths to making these large mirrors. They're what are called the thin meniscus mirrors. Those are what's used in the Gemini telescopes and European's Very Large Telescope. They're solid, but they're relatively thin. And they're relatively floppy, but you can control their shapes, and they have the advantage of they're made out of a material that has essentially zero thermal expansion. And then there's the structured mirrors, the Arizona honeycombs, which look very thick. As you can see, say in picture number 6 in your chart, and the mirror really looks thick. But as Barbara can tell us, it's about 85% empty space. That makes the mirror very rigid. Perhaps Barbara, you want to talk a bit about the structural properties of the mirror and how that allows you to control their shapes and combine them to make one coherent optical surface.
So the way the mirror is constructed, as you can see in these images, so it starts off as one monolith, and what they have in there are these silicate cores, and they fill in in image. I think it's probably image 2.
Image 2, okay. It's up.
Yes, so image 2, this is the beginning of fabrication of the mirror. And so they fill that with the glass and chunks of it. And then if you go to image 4, that is the closing of the chamber where they heat up that glass and it melts and it goes into, and if you go back to image 6, the glass fills the gaps around the core. And then that creates a nice thin, it's about 1 inch thick surface for the mirror. And then it's supported by the core in the back. So it creates this honeycomb structure that supports that thin surface of the mirror. And so then if you go to image 7, actually probably image 10 is better. That is where now that we have the finished mirror after it's been treated and the glass is formed. Then they need to hollow out the back of the mirror to create that honeycomb structure. So you can see that in image 11, where you have that the cores have been removed. So then now you have this honeycomb structure, which is a light weighted mirror. And even this itself is about 17 metric tons after it completed mirror.
I'm sorry, Barbara, I just want to see if I'm making sure I'm following this. So if I start back with image two, we start with all this, these big chunks of Pyrex that are being smoothed out. And then we go from that to the honeycomb in image six. After the heating, what is the white stuff in image six?
What is the material? I think
it's aluminous silicate. So
aluminous silicate.
You see there's glass, and inside that, though, there's this forming material, aluminous silicate foam. Yeah. It's kind of like the tiles on the old space shuttle. It withstands a lot of heat, but is still structurally very sound. And I think, as then Barbara described, after that's done, then they have to water jet all of that out to leave the hollowed out mirror. So you need something to get that hollow structure. Then you have to get rid of all that once you're finished with it.
Okay. And then you're left with image 11 is the final stage. Is that right?
Well, it's an intermediate stage. Okay. That is now you have your mirror formed, but then you need to form the surface of the mirror. So,
okay. And if I may just quick interject here. So in image 11, it's all hollowed out. It's 85% empty space, or except for air.
Right.
And it weighed how many tons?
17 metric tons.
Yikes. That's still heavy. I mean, I know it's a lot lighter than it would have been, but wow. That's okay. I thought it was 17 tons before you hollowed it out. So heavy.
When they pick it up off the floor, you're clocking in at about 40 tons. And so that's a heavy, that's an interesting lift when they lift your very expensive piece of glass off the floor and weighs 40 tons. That's when you find out whether the glue really works.
Yes. And then you can see in image eight how they do that lift. So we have a lifting fixture that has, we lift it using vacuum. So that lifting fixture. Oh, it's glue at this stage? Sorry. Yeah. So at this stage, they have an RTV-like material that they can easily remove. So they attach those points to it, and they use that to lift the mirror. In later stages, we use a vacuum lifting
on the polished surface. Once it's nice and clean, you don't want to put glue on it.
Right.
Okay. So you've hollowed out the mirror. What happens next?
Okay. If we scroll down, is there a picture of the load spreaders?
Which picture would that be?
That one. GMT Mirror 4 load spreaders.
Okay.
So in this picture number 4, the mirror is actually upside down. Mm. And they're mounting the load spreaders on the rear surface of the mirror. So where the honeycomb is exposed. And so what these load spreaders do is, so the load spreaders interface with our actuators, and I'll talk about those in a moment, but they spread the load of the weight of the mirror, and the mirror is lifted with a bed of actuators. So this step here, you can see them bonding on the load spreaders on the back surface of the mirror, and they use an RTV-like material to bond them on, and they use a laser tracker to place the position of each of those load spreaders so that we can match the location of those with the location in the interfacing part.
Hmm. And the did you, and is this particular image the central segment because of the center brown circle there, or is this one of the off-axis elements?
No, this is the center segment because there's a hole in the center.
Is now a good time to talk about the actuators, or do you want to wait on that?
That's up to you.
I would love to talk about those actuators. Okay, go ahead.
Let's talk about what they're for.
Yes. I have a piece of one sitting here right next to me to share with you.
Oh, wow. Well, then let me show you instead of the picture.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, what I'd like to show before I get into the actuator, I want to give you an overview of where they go. So if you put up my snapshot picture, M1 snapshot,
Okay, I'm looking here. M1 snapshot? I don't think I have that one.
I see it. Yes. Okay. It's B-M1 snapshot. It's the fifth image. Not fifth image.
It's a PDF.
Oh, I can't show PDFs. I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was a PDF in there.
I might be able to get this. Might be able to make this work. I think I can show my screen. So let me switch over. Try to show my screen if I can. Sorry, folks. We're just. No, I don't see a way to share my screen. Darn it.
Well, I can talk to if you put up image.
Oh, wait. I've got it.
It's all right. I got it too. Here we go.
I've got it. Here we go. All right. Well, who's sharing? Am I sharing? Are you sharing?
I got it. It's good.
Okay.
Okay. So do you have that available now?
Yep. Go ahead.
Excellent. So if you look at this image or this layout that I put together, or actually one of my team members put it together, and so it was a collaborative effort, but you can see in the top left corner a rendering of the telescope itself with all of the seven mirrors in their flower shape. Then if you take one of those mirrors and expand it out, you can see a mirror standalone to the right of it. And so now that's the front surface of the mirror that is, you know, looking into deep space. Then below that, you can see an expanded mirror of the assembly of the mirror with the cell and all of the components below it. So what you're looking at is the front surface of the mirror, and then behind that you can see what we call the cell of the mirror. That is the structure that supports the mirror and all of the M1 subsystem that that positions the mirror and offloads the weight and any temperature gradients that are in it. That's what the actuators function are. And so below the cell, you can see a bunch of components behind it. And then to the right is the triple actuator itself. You can see this device that's on like a tripod. That is what we call a triple actuator. And then the actuator itself, inside it, are three air cylinders. And then you can see an exploded view of the air cylinder itself. And so those actuators support each of the mirrors. There are 80 single actuators around the perimeter of the mirror, and there are 90 triple actuators throughout the rest of the mirror. And we have that so that the mirrors can be positioned at any orientation of the telescope. It will be able to support the weight of the mirror. And we can also interchange the mirrors, because the mirrors will be on a cycle. You know, they'll need to have the surfaces cleaned, and we'll need to recoat them over time. So we need to be able to interchange the mirrors. So the triple actuators, they counteract the effects of gravity. Earlier we'd mentioned how heavy the mirror is, even in its hollowed out state. And then also, this is exposed to the atmosphere, and so the temperature is going to be quite cold, and there could be very windy, so there could be a temperature gradient across the mirror. But we want the mirror as a nice, even temperature. And so what the actuators do is they apply forces onto the back of the mirror so that we can have the prescription of the mirror stay as close to our requirement as possible, and so that we can have the best image quality as possible.
So just to clarify, so you're saying that the actuators are not, you don't set them once and then that's it. They're going to adjust and push, pull, or I don't know about pull, but push on specific parts of the mirror from behind to keep its shape adjusted as the telescope is moving, and even throughout the night as the temperature changes?
Correct.
Wow.
Every 30 seconds.
Yes.
Every 30 seconds.
Okay.
Focus, recollimate, and adjust the forces on the mirrors.
Correct.
And this is not to be confused with an adaptive optic system, is it?
No. This is what we call active optics, because it's controlled actively, but but not adaptively. And the adaptive takes out distortions introduced by the atmosphere. And you sense you might think that Barbara's job is to deliver the perfect telescope. And then there's another group doing adaptive optics that has to get rid of the atmosphere.
That just puts a lot more pressure.
But you need to start with the right shape of the mirror to begin with.
Right, right. Because adaptive optics won't help if the mirror is out of prescription. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I didn't realize how much just went into just supporting the mirror. And keep in mind, this is just one of seven mirrors. And so you're going to have, seven of these systems, each with 90 actuators.
Yeah. And there's one more layer of complication. So that's what you see to the right on that picture. To the left is a hard point. And so the mirrors are mounted on a hexapod. So there are six of these hard points mounted to two in three different locations. And what they do, they don't take any load. That's the actuator's job. But what they do is they position the mirrors relative to each other. We call that phasing, so that the mirrors operate as one monolithic surface.
Hmm. Cool.
Wow.
Yeah. And then another challenge that we have, besides getting us all to work, I don't know if you noticed in the news over the weekend, there was a 6.7 earthquake in Chile.
I did not know that. Oh, no.
In La Serena, which is the closest city to where the Giant Magellan Telescope is going to be located. And wow. So there's a pretty sizable seismic environment and a pretty, high probability that, the telescope could see an earthquake in its future. And so one of the things that we're designing into the actuators is a damper. So in case there is a seismic event, we can mitigate against any, damage that it could potentially cause. So if you look on that image there, you see the cross section. So that's the air cylinder itself. And so I have an actual picture of one. Let me see if I can show you here. So you look here, this is a transparent tube and of our air cylinder, as you can see in that cross section there.
Lift it and up just a tidge. There you go. Good.
Oh, there we go. Oh, so sorry.
Thank you.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is an actual air cylinder. This is a prototype that we built to test to make sure we have, the right, leak rate and the right pressure and that we can control it, the way that that we have designed it. But one of the other concerns that we have that we discovered last year is that we're worried that during a seismic event that this will act as a pump. And then when it pumps, it will create a vacuum on one of the chambers here. And so we wanted to test to see if that would occur. And we have shown that it is possible. And when you pull a vacuum on here, the diaphragm that you see here, which we call a velophram, it kind of implodes a little bit. And if that happens, when we go to repressurize it, it could potentially, damage one of the velophrams. And so when we add the dampers in here, it'll slow that rate of pumping to help prevent that. And then we'll also put in a check valve. So we're designing in, mitigation to prevent that from happening. So we created this and so that you can see, what is occurring when we test this to see what the impact is of a seismic event.
So what would you say in terms of on the Richter scale, how resilient do you think this would be? What kind of earthquake do you expect this to be able to withstand?
We are designing the telescope, so it's not just the actuators that we're putting in protection. We're also
right.
putting in, in the we are having an isolation system at the base of the telescope.
Oh, yes, okay.
I'm not very familiar with that design, so okay. I can't do much to it. But we have been working on our seismic analysis, and the range of earthquake that Chile could see is from 7 to 9. We're still defining, what the probability is of what size of earthquake that we are designing to. So I don't have that specific number just yet. But that's the range in which the level of earthquakes that area could see.
Yeah, in practical terms, it's about a magnitude 8 plus that we have to survive. and we've spec this to the maximum likely earthquake to occur in a 2,500 year period. So we're being pretty conservative because, as Barbara said, if we break one of the mirrors, it's really bad luck. And if you break seven, it's catastrophic bad luck.
Yeah.
We really have to protect our investment, the investment for our stakeholders, to make sure that the probability of damage during a seismic event is lower than all other risks. And so we have a pretty good understanding now of the seismic behavior in Chile. And now we've been doing the engineering to make sure that the telescope, and most importantly, that the precious optics would come through any such event unscathed. And that's something that's new to all of these next generation telescopes. They're now on a scale where the amplification and the accelerations that occur in a big earthquake threaten their very survival, whereas the smaller telescopes didn't have that so much. And also we just have a better understanding of the seismic environment, and we have better analytic tools to predict how the telescope will respond to ground motion.
Well, it's very interesting in the view of the earthquake situation and the primary mirror design that you've come up with. I want to read a couple of comments from Charlie, because I understand where he's coming from here, and I'm a little confused about, I'm not confused, but I wonder about the choice of Pyrex. He goes, E6, which is Pyrex, is not zero expansion coefficient material. E6 is what these mirrors are made from. So you need to control the mirror temperatures closely and bend out any thermal deformation. Then he comments later, thermal control is also important to avoid mirror seeing. That is that the mirror needs to be within 1 degree C of the air temperature to avoid thermal air currents on the mirror surface. Can you comment on that? Are you going to be controlling the temperatures of the primaries?
Yes. If you go back to that image on the snapshot, and if you look at the bottom section of the picture.
I'm sorry, which image do you want me to put up?
The PDF.
Oh, okay.
The
PDF M1 snapshot is what I call it.
It's up. Okay.
And so if you look at the bottom portion of the picture, that you'll see on, it's the bottom left, there's a series of heat exchangers and fan units. And so our thermal system, what it does, and then there's also an array of nozzles. And those nozzles are being sized and the flow rate is being sized. But basically what's happening is we're pushing air into the back surface of the mirror. So those nozzles will protrude into the honeycomb structure and will bring in air in there to keep the mirror cool at just the right temperature. Or actually, it's really to keep the gradient out, to keep it at a nice even temperature. And so basically the cell that you see there, we pump air into there so it becomes a lower plenum and it's pressurized. And then the air pushes up through the nozzles into the back surface of the mirror. And then it's drawn out back into the cell. So it recirculates itself.
Wow, that's really cool. So it's and you have 50 of those mounted on the bottom of each mirror cell, each mirror hard point.
There are 50 fans and then a lot more nozzles. Okay. Since we're pressurizing that, it's pushing the air up evenly through all of the nozzles. The fans draw the air out of the back of the mirror.
But your listener makes a very good point, and we have confidence in this technology because we're using it now on our 6.5 meter telescopes. We understand the thermal properties, we understand the control, and the way we know we're doing this well is that we can compare the seeing delivered by the atmosphere to the seeing delivered by the telescope, and they match with astonishing accuracy. So this issue of thermal gradients and mirror seeing, we take very seriously. And fortunately, we've already tested and proven this technology on the current generation of telescopes. That's what gives us the confidence that it will work on the GMT.
Great. I've got the rendering back up again, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the secondary. I know, Barbara, you're the primary person, but maybe you could just comment. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 of these 7 segments are off-axis elements. What kind of secondary is sitting at the end of that pier, that tress? Is it a single optical surface? Is it a combination of optical surfaces? Hello?
So
oh.
Basically the secondary mirror is segmented in exactly the same way as the primary mirror. So there's one secondary mirror for each primary, and that gives us a lot of control points, in essence, for maintaining the alignment of the telescope, particularly in the face of wind buffeting. So you can think of the secondary as an upside down but scaled version of the primary, in which the individual segments are 1.1 meters in diameter rather than 8.4, and six of those are off axis and the central one is on axis.
Okay. Wow. So for every element in the primary, there is a corresponding element in the secondary, which will give you a focus down at the image plane.
Yeah. And since it's a Gregorian, the secondary is located beyond the prime focus. And so light from one primary mirror travels to the secondary on the opposite side and then brought back to the focus through the hole in the central primary.
So you've got light crisscrossing each other a little bit as they reach the secondaries. I understand that the secondary mirrors are, I understand you have two assemblies of secondary, and one of them is designed for adaptive optics. So maybe now would be a good time to talk a little bit about the adaptive optics system. Can you tell us just briefly about how it works? And
sure. So the idea, the way I like to describe an adaptive optics system is it's kind of like your noise-canceling headphones. And the way noise-canceling headphones work, as you well know, is they sense the signal you don't want, which is the noise, and then they put that wavefront into a deformable membrane, like a speaker, but exactly out of phase with the noise. So when the signal hits the distorted surface, the noise cancels out, and you're just left with the sound that you want. Hmm. Adaptive optics is the same concept, where we measure the wavefront distortions imposed by the atmosphere, we put them onto a deformable mirror, but exactly out of phase. And so when the wavefront hits that deformed mirror, it's restored to its original flat wavefront shape. And the challenge compared to, say, an audio headphone is we have to do this at optical wavelengths, which are very, very small, as you well know. And that out of phase features, that signature changes about 500 times a second. So you have to be able to change the shape on your deformable mirror at a rate of about 500 hertz to a kilohertz. Now, ideally, you'd like to do this on the primary mirror itself. That would give you the best correction, but no one has yet figured out how to make an adaptive primary mirror. Typically, telescopes either have small mirrors inside reimaging systems to do this deformable element, or they use the secondary mirror of the telescope itself. The secondary is kind of the second best place to do this adaptive correction because it gives you a wide field of view, you don't have any extra reflections, you don't have any extra backgrounds. So what we do is we follow on the technology developed in Arizona and Italy, is we have a mirror that's, about 2 millimeters thick for the adaptive shells. And behind that, we have voice coil actuators. They're kind of like, they do the same job that the actuators that Barbara showed you, but they run at 500 hertz to a kilohertz. And so they're constantly adjusting the shape of those mirrors. Wow. I think they move them a fraction of a micron or two at the most. And they constantly change their shape to cancel out the atmospheric distortions and deliver a diffraction limit image to the telescope focus, where the science instruments can use that either to look for planets near bright stars, to measure the mass of black holes, or look at the structures of galaxies and star-forming regions.
That's amazing. So this is really, this is going to effectively cancel out the turbulence of the atmosphere. But as you mentioned, this is within a micron. So these are suited for infrared observations, I imagine, right?
I said that the total stroke is a micron. The accuracy has to be about 20 nanometers because the telescope should be diffraction limited at wavelengths shorter than what the atmosphere will produce. So we expect this to work down to around 1 micron, and they'll get, progressively worse corrections as you go to shorter wavelengths. We have another approach to deal with short wavelengths, but this is really a 1 to 10 micron kind of capability.
Okay. So was I correct in saying that this is going to be really effective in the infrared part, or will this also work in optical wavelengths?
No, you're right. This is really an infrared capability.
Cool. Great. So tell me about the short wavelength, the optical stuff. Are there ways of cheating the atmosphere there too? Or
up to a point, there's two things that limit your ability to correct the wavefront errors. One is the number of actuators, or the spacing of actuators on the primary mirror. Because as you get to shorter wavelengths and you want to still be lambda over 20, you have to work to smaller and smaller correction scales. And then the atmospheric time constants become shorter as you get to these small scales. So you have to have more actuators and you have to have them run faster. So our team at University of Arizona is doing this kind of work on the 6.5 meter telescopes at Las Campanas. And they found they can do good adaptive optics correction down to the wavelength of H alpha. So about 6/10 of a micron.
Wow.
They can even do it a little shorter. They've even set up where they put an eyepiece on the telescope and you can look in and you can see a diffraction limited image with your eye, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Wow.
It requires a fairly bright star, but if you're interested in planets around stars, that's okay. So the way they do it is they use small mechanically, commercially produced deformable mirrors that are driven by the usual liquid crystal display. That have very high actuator counts. They have relatively small stroke, but very high actuator density. They work on very bright stars and a tiny, tiny field of view. We're talking about corrections only across about 3 arc seconds. But if what you want to look at is very, very small, pushing down to those very fine scales, 3 arc seconds still has a lot of resolution elements. So we're looking at a way to adapt that technology to GMT that would give us this high frequency tweeter capability, in essence, to push the adaptive optics to short wavelengths, to very high contrast, which is really what you need to do to look for planets. Because if you were on Alpha Centauri, looking back at our solar system, you'd say Jupiter, well, it's only reflecting about one part in 100 million of the sun's light. Mm-hmm. And it's an arc second or so away. The Earth, which is actually 1 arc second away, is reflecting one part in a few hundred million. So that's a pretty hard contrast. That's pretty tough to do. So that's why we want to do this exoplanet science. We have to take the AO to the next level, the so-called extreme adaptive optics, to get this very high contrast. So we're trying to develop a technological path forward on that. And as always, though, it comes down to good control of the optics, good position placement, thermal control, and then this very high speed adaptive optics.
Fantastic. Thank you. So there is interest in getting there. Obviously, I know there's interest in getting there, but there is as you said, there's a path that might in fact get us there. So that's great. Tony, what would you want to, did you want to talk about anything on the instrument side, or because I know we've got a couple questions coming in and I know we're starting to run out of time.
Well, I was hoping to get to where we are in construction at some point. Okay. and you know, how things are going on that. I mean, you've given some site photos. I'd like to show some of those and maybe talk about where you are right now on construction and when you're hoping to see first light.
Right. Okay. In the pictures you can see, let's see, it's probably best to look at, they don't have the greatest names, site-26 or so. That's a drone image of the overall site. So we'll back up a bit. We spent a lot of time testing the site to make sure we understood its atmospheric properties. We have 30 years of weather data at this location in Chile, so we know we've got a good site from that point of view. We wanted to make sure we were at a place where the airflow was good. We then leveled the top of the mountain in 2012. So that took some work. We had to move about 40,000 cubic meters of rock. So that would take 9 meters off the top of the mountain. Then we did a little more testing. And now that the telescope and the enclosure design are approaching their final state, we've started to excavate the top of the mountain to put in the foundations, in essence, for the dome that protects the telescope and for the telescope pier itself. Because as anyone who has a telescope in their backyard knows, if you don't put it on a solid foundation and it just shakes all the time, it just drives you crazy. So the telescope sits on a massive concrete pier, and we dig foundations into the rock to make that extra stable. So if you look at site 38, that's them digging the hole where the telescope pier foundations will be. And we expect to finish and complete all of this excavation in the next month or so. Then we'll do some cleanup and we're putting in some more power lines and getting the water system set. And we've upgraded the roads and we have housing for 250 people. And right now we have about 100 people on the site every day doing the construction work. And around late in this calendar year, which is sort of the next summer season in Chile, we'll start putting in the rebar and then pour the concrete for the foundations. It's a little more challenging than, say, pouring concrete in your backyard if you're going to, fix up your garage or something, because you're on a remote mountaintop, 2 or 3 hours from any city. So you just don't have the concrete trucks drive up. You have to have a concrete plant on top of the mountain. You have to mix all the concrete there. And naturally, you want to do this in one single pour that'll take about 2 or 3 days. So it's an interesting civil engineering challenge to build this infrastructure on top of the mountain. So that's the work going on right now in construction in Chile, but there's a whole nother set of activities, of course, to build the precision machinery that will go in place on the mountain. So we've been working for many years to finalize the design of the telescope, and now we're working to select a vendor who can do out all the details and then manufacture the telescope. And I would say in the next 3 to 6 weeks, we will choose from two vendors who've submitted binding fixed price proposals to us, and we'll pick one of those, work with them for about 18 months to detail out the design, and then they'll start cutting the steel to put it all together. And we should have that telescope assembled in a factory in around 2023 or 24, check it all out, and then we have to get it down to Chile, along with Barbara's mirrors, you know, and getting the 7 mirrors from Arizona to the top of the mountain is another interesting story. And we've started to work on that in the sense that we have the first mirror in its shipping container. We've moved it across town, so we know how that works. And we have shipped mirrors to Chile in the past, so we understand how that all works. So around 2024, the dome will be constructed and closed, at least so that everything is out of the wind. The telescope will be shipped from wherever it is being built, and some number of the primary mirrors will have made it to the top of the mountain, and then you have to start putting it all together. And that'll take a while. That'll take a year or more to put it all together, and then another year to really shake it out to make sure everything works. So there's a lot ahead of us, but it's exciting to actually be digging in the ground, getting ready to pour concrete, really seeing stuff come together after about 10 years of design. Now we're really starting to see hardware and earth moving equipment, and it's a very exciting time for us.
Wow. So we're looking at about mid-2020s then. Can I go ahead and show this one that says Summit 1 RGB?
Sure.
I think that's the finished, or that's the rendering of what it's going to look like when you're all done.
That's right.
And that's beautiful. Look at that. I mean, that thing, I love the cars there for scale. That's absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed that enclosure. It's it almost looks like it's large enough to fit a second telescope in there. Do you know why that enclosure is so oversized for especially very tall? How would you describe, or do you know why?
You want to talk about this? Has to do with how we handle the primary mirrors.
Oh, it does. Oh, probably for installing them and taking them out.
Yep.
You know, I'm not as familiar with the enclosure design, but when you have the mirror in the, can you hand me the model over there?
There you go.
So there's a model. So when we go to remove a mirror and
oh, I want one of those. Sorry.
Yeah. Where can we buy those?
We can send them to you.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So here's a paper model of the telescope itself, and so there's a crane in the enclosure that will go down, and we'll have a vacuum lifting fixture that mounted to that crane, so that we can lift a mirror off of the telescope and then down onto a transport vehicle, so that we can move the mirror into a neighboring facility. So if you go back to the picture here, the first one, I can't see a number.
It's at the Summit One.
Summit One, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a building you see there next to the telescope. So we're going to be putting a coating chamber in there. So we need to be able to recoat the mirrors throughout. The telescope has a 50-year life. And so we need to remove those and recoat them on a periodic basis. And so you need that much space to be able to lift the mirror off in a safe manner and set it down onto its transport vehicle.
Okay. So the enclosure might play a role in supporting the cranes, and that's probably why it's as tall as it is, or that is why it's as tall as it is.
Yes. We have tried to find any number of solutions that could make that a little smaller, but the overhead crane just drives that.
Yeah.
But the key thing about the enclosure, you look at all the openings in the side, our requirement is that the enclosure be more than 40% open to airflow when we're operating. that's to get this isothermal profile that Barbara talked about. So the air inside the dome is the same as outside. The temperatures of the mirror is the same as the ambient air. And we find that in Chile, that's the key to good image quality, is good thermal control.
Fantastic. Yeah. So I guess it's also heated and air conditioned inside during the daytime to...
You'll have to wear your coat if you like. We don't heat. We need to air condition it during the day or not. The telescopes we have there currently, we do not air condition, because the nice thing about these coastal sites in Chile is the difference between the daytime temperature and the nighttime temperature is not so high. So you don't have to manage that much. But it's a big building sitting in the sun. So we have engineered it to allow air conditioning. We just haven't yet decided if that's necessary. That's part of our ongoing thermal and airflow modeling that we're doing. And some of that we're doing with the Boeing company. And you know, those guys know how airflow works. So they're really fun to work with.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then one other element of construction, if you scroll up, there is an image of two people.
At site 38?
The test cell.
The test cell. Yes. There's one with Barbara and the GMT outside test cell.
Yes.
Yes.
There's two images, one inside, which is the... Oh, they're labeled. Okay.
Which is it? Oh, there it is.
There are two of them. So let's talk about the one on the outside, which is GMT outside. So that's an actual scale. It's shorter than the actual test cells that we're going to build. And the reason it's shorter is so that it fits underneath the test tower at University of Arizona. Hmm. And we're building this to prove out to, we're building a complete actuator and hardpoint support and system. Sorry, I'm getting my words all mixed up here. So basically, we're building out a complete test cell, which will is very similar to the actual test cell that we'll have on the telescope. But the actuators and the hardpoints are going to be production hardpoints and actuators. And this way, we can test out our control system to make sure, as Pat was talking about in our active optic system. We're developing the software for that, and then we want to make sure that it is safe to put glass on. So we're building an actual mirror simulator, which will simulate the weight and CG of a mirror that we'll put on top of the support structure, and then test out our control system. And then once we have determined that it's safe to put glass on and that we have that working, we're going to put an actual mirror on it. And then that way we can confirm that the polishing process that we're doing with the mirrors has given us the prescription that we want. And we'll test that underneath the test tower. It'll also be able to prove we've developed a finite element model that simulates the stresses within the mirror. And so we want to be able to correlate that model to actual test. And so that will occur in a couple of years from now. So right now we're in the process of building up this test cell, which is nearing completion. This is the exterior of it. And then the other image that says interior, that's the interior of the test cell itself. So what you see above us are some holes that are being drilled out, and that's where the actuators will interface. There's one more image that B, which is labeled test cell top plate, and you can see this clover shaped machined part. That is where the triple actuator interfaces. So the triple actuator will mount underneath that top plate, and then there's a interface plate that bolts to the load spreader on the back of the mirror. And so we will mount the mirror on top of the actuator, which will be underneath this top plate.
Holy cow, this thing just keeps getting more and more complicated. There's also a picture of the triple actuator too. I'm showing that real quick that you had in your diagram. That's good for scale.
So in that picture, you can see it's the angle of it. It's kind of hard to see the clover leaf shape, but that's this where Damien's hand is, where it's that flat surface there. That is what mounts to the backside of that top plate. And then what you're seeing here, the blue, those are the load cells on the air cylinders. And the interior is what I showed you earlier here in my hand. And then those three interface with that plate there. That is what bolts to the load spreader. And so the forces you can see are applied, in those three directions that work together to apply one force into the back of the mirror.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to stop there. We didn't get a chance to talk about the instruments or ways in which things are getting paid for, things like that. But I wanted to talk more about the collaboration as well. But we're out of time, unfortunately. So I'm going to have to stop the hangout there. I want to thank our guests so much. Our guests today are Barbara Fisher and Patrick McCarthy. Patrick is the vice president of the Giant Magellan Telescope, and Barbara Fisher is the primary mirror subsystem lead for the Giant Magellan Telescope. Thank you guys so much for taking time out to tell us all about this amazing system, which we can start looking forward to in a few years, it sounds like.
Let me also add, Barbara and Patrick, just thank you both very much for coming on today. And as Tony said, I feel like we're kind of cutting ourselves off mid-conversation. There's so much more to talk about. We'd love to have you guys back at some point, and especially talk a little about the progress made between today and the next time we talk about, and get into more stuff.
Okay. Look forward to it.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for being here. And on behalf of Christian Reddy from Launchpad Astronomy, I want to thank you all so much for watching. And as always, keep looking up.